Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 98, recorded December 9th, 2010. Wait for Sandy Bridge.
This episode of Twitch is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off the lifetime of your new account, go to squarespace.com and use offer code Twitch.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. I am Patrick Norton. Joining me, as always, Mr. Ryan Shrout. Are you there, sir?
I am indeed.
I have powerful news. As of this morning, apparently, the beloved This Week in Computer Hardware podcast joins Freakonomics Radio, the Nerdist, WorkoutMusic.com, Tech News Today, the Joe Rogan Experience, Jay and Silent Bob Get Old, the Smodcast, and quite a few others as a iTunes Best of 2000 or iTunes 2010 Best of Audio Podcast. So you are elite,
that's
dude.
That's good news. That's good news for us, isn't it?
It is good news.
Hopefully, so that means the new subscribers will be streaming in as well.
There'll be a for everyone who's new to the podcast after we were listed on iTunes.
That's right.
I'd like to tell you, we talk about computer hardware, computer hardware, pretty much how to make it run faster, how to make it work better, how to basically not get screwed when you're whipping out the credit card or the cash to pay for your new toy. And we take a lot of viewer questions. So do us a favor, email us your viewer questions. You can send it to us on Twitter. I'm at Patrick Norton. And where are you at, Mr. Shrout, on the Twitter?
A very creatively named at Ryan Shrout on Twitter as well.
And you can also email us at twitch@twit.tv. We are wont to do, we are going to begin this episode with yet another graphics card review, the NVIDIA GeForce GTX 571, 1.25 gigabytes. Something new. I was kind of hoping for a 2 gigabyte GPU review. Why 1.25 gigabytes, or is that a typo?
You trying to tell me you're not excited about new graphics cards every week? It's not every week, but we do seem to lead with graphics cards quite a bit, don't we?
I'm ready for sort of you know what I mean? I think everybody's kind of released everything. Then they're going to do a bunch of announcements about products that aren't going to exist for 6 months. There's going to be a lot of Sandy Bridge happiness at CES 2011 in a few weeks. I'm waiting for a gentle pause where we can all stop and decide to buy GPUs before they start ramping up with all new – well, actually, whether or not they're ramping up with all new silicon later this year, you're going to comment on that in a minute. But tell us now, is it safe to buy a GPU, and should we be looking at the GTX 570?
I would say, editor's note, probably leading with a graphics card next week as well. So we'll keep that in mind.
Damn it, the lull between the cards, it keeps evading us.
After that, I think we'll have a lull for a little while. Not an LOL, but an LAWL, if I spelled that correctly. But the GTX 570, so this is based on the GF110 GPU, almost the same GPU as the GTX 580 we talked about a couple, 3 weeks ago. That GPU was 1.5 gigabytes. This is 1.25 gigabytes memory size, as you mentioned. And the reason for that is because it has a slightly smaller memory bus width. So instead of having a 384-bit memory bus, it has a 320-bit memory bus. And when that happens, it just kind of works out so that X number of memory per memory channel, which is like a division of 64 bits of memory. So in this case, 256 megs of memory, fewer channels, so therefore there is that much less frame buffer on there. Still a good amount. I still think the norm is probably now a gigabyte. There are some cards that have 2 gigabytes. There are some cards that are coming out that have 2 gigabytes as well, but there are some out there that have 2 gigs. It's kind of, frame buffer is one of those things. It's only really important if you're doing ultra, ultra high res, or you are pushing anti-aliasing levels to the highest maximum, like edge adaptive, not just multi-sample, but maybe coverage sample AA. When you're doing all kinds of AAs to get the topmost image quality you can, that's when it becomes important. The 570 compared to the 580 has one less streaming multiprocessor, which means it has fewer shader cores in it. This has 480 shader processors, CUDA cores as NVIDIA calls them, compared to the 512 cores on the GTX 580. So this is basically almost equivalent to the previous. Remember, the GTX 480 was the super high-end part in the last, I don't want to say last generation, but the last release. This is almost equivalent to that in terms of performance and specs. There's a couple of minor differences with the memory and REST or operators and stuff like that that we don't need to get into. In terms of performance, it's very, very, very similar. Beats it in most cases, falls behind it in just a couple of cases, but we're talking handful of percentages difference between this and the 480. The benefit, of course, to this is that this is comes at a lower price. It starts at $349 is kind of the estimated MSRP on this part, whereas the 480 as of yesterday, the day before, was selling for $430, $440. So we're seeing like a good $70 to $80 price drop for the same performance with the GTX 570. And the 480s are not, you know, they're basically end of life. What's out there now, you know, if you want a second one to do SLI, start paying attention to that. As stock is gone, it will not be coming back. So that's kind of an
important safety tip. So yeah, FutureMark 3D Mark 11 DirectX 11 testing gets more robust, gets more real. Are you guys going to be immediately flipping over to this, or just add it to the suite alongside the current FutureMark benchmarks?
So what we'll probably do is add 3D Mark 11 to our benchmark suite in the next review cycle. And we don't want to just 3D Mark Vantage has been around for a long time, and it is definitely long in the tooth. It has very few kind of DirectX 10 features. 3D Mark 11, not only stands for 2011, which is, you know, we're almost to that year, but it also stands for DX 11 because you have to have a DX 11 capable graphics card to run this benchmark with, you know, in order to get a default benchmark score, you have to have a DX 11 ready graphics card. This has also been in development for a long time, but Vantage is still important because so many people have that software. So many people have results based on that software that it's good kind of legacy information to keep around. So even as AMD and NVIDIA release new parts, probably for the next maybe 12 months, we'll have results from that. 3D Mark 11 is one of those things where, you know, we're at a 1.0 version release. It's really pretty to look at. You know, you can go to futuremark.com and download the free version of it and play it back and watch it on your hardware, which is always nice. It's good, like, graphical demo, if nothing else. But as with all 1.0 software, we kind of worry about if 1.01 or 1.1 will slightly tweak the way the benchmark results come out. So we're not going to put a whole lot of stock into the results yet, but we got to start gathering them. So if we're gathering them, we might as well present them to our listeners and readers and stuff.
There's nothing worse than like doing a whole bunch of benchmarking. Basically, do a whole bunch of benchmarking, and then the update to the benchmark comes out to fix things, and you find out it varies more than, like, you know, 3% back in the day when we were running a lot of the ZD benchmarks. Like 3% was the margin of statistical insignificance, but anything over 3%, and you had to retest everything from the old days or from the older machines. That's having to retest everything because the benchmark changes significantly is a giant bag of suck.
It is. But 3D Mark is one of those kind of industry standards, which is kind of disappointing because we like real world gaming testing. The rest of the world likes these tests that you can click a button, run, come back, get a score. It's quick, it's easy. Those types of things. And those are important for some things, right? It's important for just quick glances at performance and evaluations. So, you know, we're going to use it, and they present interesting synthetic benchmarks, you know, specific, very, very individualized tests on certain things that are always good to compare GPU architectures. So they can, if you guys check next week or the next couple of weeks, we'll have some 3D Mark 11 testing in some of our upcoming articles. So
nice. So one of the articles I noticed this week that kind of stood out, Nantech.com did a roundup of 1,000 to 12,000 watts. Yeah, that would be scary. Just thinking about the amount of amperage that would be sucking through your socket before the circuit breakers blew. They did a roundup of 1,000 watts to 1,200 watts, basically high-end PSUs. And it's really funny because I see a lot of people that are running around with very modest systems, but they've got a 1,000-watt power supply because they need the overhead. And the reality is if you're not running like 3 to 4 GPUs in a stack of hard drives, you do not need a 1,000-watt, much less a 1,200-watt power supply. But one of the other things I found out is kind of every time I see somebody do a really serious roundup of power supplies, it comes back to one of the problems I've been seeing ever since people started doing serious power supply testing, is that a lot of power supplies suck. And I bring that up partially because a poorly engineered power supply, there can be voltage variations, there can be ripple, there can be, you know, heating problems, it can be incredibly inefficient. And I bring that up because a lot of things we blame on, like my hard drive sucks or Windows sucks or OS X sucks, can actually be related back to problems with the power that hits the motherboard and then the hard drive. And basically, you need a good power supply to have an overall solid computing experience, especially if you want nice, safe data. I'm not going to get too deep into it because I want people to go read the article for themselves. But it was shocking. They did 5 fairly pricey power supply units, and the line I'm going to leave everybody with is, at the moment, many manufacturers want to reach 80-plus gold faster than the competition, which is why we're seeing problems with the design, because they're in such a rush they don't have time to correct their mistakes. So I'm going to leave that little teaser for you to go over to Nantech.com and check that one out. They do have an editor's choice with reservation, so if you are thinking about buying a gigantic power supply for your gigantic gaming machine with multiple GPUs and hard drives, I would highly recommend checking out the testing before I did so, because some of the power supplies out there suck a lot more than they need to, at least for the money they're paying.
Figuratively and actually.
Oh, my goodness. We should take a quick ad break, and then we're going to come back with an email from Kyle, who is suffering from the pain of a dead motherboard and potentially a dead CPU. And a lot of questions about Sandy Bridge, which is Intel's next-gen processor.
As you mentioned, this episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. Squarespace.com has an easy-to-use user interface for creating and managing a website or blog. It's optimized for both beginners and CSS experts, so if you want to get down into the nitty-gritty of coding, you can actually do that. Or you can use one of their hundreds of design templates and customize them as you see fit. It's an all-inclusive service. It includes several modules to build your website, including blogs, import and export for WordPress, Blogger, movable type, TypePad. It has forums. It has a form builder, so you can collect email addresses or other information from your site visitors. It has Flickr photo display, Twitter widgets, Google Maps, a whole lot more. It also does website tracking and built-in search engine optimization, permission access handling if you want to have multiple users, update the site if you and your friends want to start a multi-user blog. It's based on a cloud architecture for speed and site stability, which basically means if you guys get a lot of traffic, even as you're growing, you don't have to worry about your site being shut down or your server being overwhelmed because of additional traffic. The cloud architecture they have is built just for that. It has an innovative drag-and-drop AJAX interface, so if you don't know code, but you have an idea about what you want to do design, maybe this block should go over here, this column should move over here, it has a really easy kind of drag-and-drop functionality there for you to do some of those kinds of modifications. It has an iPhone app where you can log in your website and update it on the go without having to load up the whole page. That's pretty handy. So you can use Squarespace for all of your website needs. Build it, host it, and update it at any time. For a free trial, all you have to do is go to squarespace.com. No credit card needed. Just try it out and build your website. You get 2 free weeks. You get to see all the configuration options you can have, what kind of customizations you want. And then if you decide to purchase it, if you use offer code TWITCH, you get 10% off of the lifetime of your account. So for as long as you have an account with them, you'll get 10% off of your services. That's squarespace.com, offer code TWITCH, T-W-I-C-H, and we thank them for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware.
Not to laugh at Squarespace. Squarespace is an amazing system for web hosting. But I'm just laughing. Like the opening to Kyle's email, he's got a quick question, right? Basically, he opens up quick question. Is my CPU dead? I'm getting a Gigabyte GA X58 USB 3, change the cooler of the i7-950 to a Zygmatek Thor's Hammer, which is a ridiculous name for a cooler. I just had to say that. Thor's Hammer! I'm just not getting the whole icy hammer of Thor cooling your CPU angle. He says, when I started, it got a smell of smoke and then brought it to a friend, removed the CMOS, and then without the CMOS, started it. Fan spun, but got a spark between the USB ports and Northbridge heat pipe. I'm sure the board is dead, but not sure about the CPU. Can't find any shop or friend here in the Philippines who has an X58 board. Hope you can help. Thanks. The easiest way to figure out if the CPU is still alive is to drop it into a any compatible motherboard and see if the thing boots. If it doesn't boot, either in the what I consider particularly alarming fashion, the motherboard will start speaking to you through the speaker. I still haven't gotten used to that. The CPU is dead. More likely, you'll get a series of beeps that you go into the manual and decide is the postcode, the power on self-TED. You know. Right. Three dots, a space, three long dots, a space. Oh, that means my CPU is dead. So if we have anybody in the Philippines who's got access to an X58 board and is brave enough to let Kyle drop his CPU in there to see if the CPU is dead, give him a shot. I mean, the thing is, Kyle, is painful as this is, you can, you know, I would say call Gigabyte, see if you can do an RMA on the board. You know, hopefully I've had a couple boards go on me in the last few years. One went quietly, one went not so quietly. Seeing sparks between the USB ports and the Northbridge heat pipe is a little unusual.
Yes.
Yeah, is extremely unusable. I would call Gigabyte. I would be very polite. Said my motherboard exploded, and I would like to replace it. and they will probably give you an RMA number. And then hopefully, right, when you get the motherboard back, you will drop your CPU into it, and everything will, your i7-950 and everything will run. I'm kind of 50-50. Like, I want to tell you it's a 98% possibility that your CPU is fine. But when you're talking about enough, you know, the magic smoke comes out. So probably a little tiny capacitor or resistor blew out on the motherboard, one of those tiny little surface mount components. It's all it takes is one little piece of silicon that's about a, you know, millimeter apart, and your motherboard becomes like the world's most useless paperweight. But I'm going to say 50-50, and I'm going to hope that it's the 50% that your CPU is still alive. You know, nice. It's – I mean, because – well, it's kind of funny. Like, CPUs used to be really fragile, and then they got pretty much indestructible. And then we started overclocking, and then they started getting more destructible. And then AMD decided, let's put the silicon on the outside of the chip with nothing protecting it. And then I discovered how easy it was to crack silicon.
And they don't do that anymore, though.
No, they don't. And nobody does that anymore. It's really expensive in terms of really angry users. But, you know, CPUs are pretty hard to kill these days, but an overvoltage is one way to do it. I'm hoping everything's fine. Call Gigabyte. Hopefully they'll RMA you a new motherboard and drop your CPU in there and see if that helps. And if anybody out there in the Philippines has an X58 board that they're willing to let Kyle drop his i7-950 into, do us a favor, email us twitch@twit.tv, and we'll try to get you guys hooked up, see if we can take care of Kyle.
There you go. We got a message from Android Bruce on Twitter. Says, is there any proof that an SSD is less reliable than a hard drive? Should you run your cache on separate disks with an SSD? Is there any proof that an SSD is less reliable? I would say no. I'd say there's proof that an SSD is more reliable in terms of like shock resistance and that type of thing. Like, this is one of those deals where hard drives have been around for decades, spinning disks. We have lots of data of you know, millions of hours of real-world usage and end-user usage, and SSDs are still relatively new, even though it feels like I've been talking about them forever. it's only been a couple, 3 years. I can't for sure say if they're less or more reliable. I would lean with more reliable, and I could tell you that everybody that I know, I recommend SSDs to everybody, are our storage guru, Alan, who would not risk losing his many, many terabytes of data, or time for that matter, would not be using them if he didn't feel like they're reliable. As for running your cache on separate disks, I'm not exactly sure what he's talking about. I think he might be like Windows swap partition.
File, most likely, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the issue that that comes into is, are you going to wear down the flash memory itself over time if you use it as a swap drive? And yeah, you're going to wear it down faster. But it's the same thing as like saying, is overclocking my CPU, if it's running at the right temperature, is really going to lower the lifespan of my processor? And the answer is probably yes. But if you're going to take it from 20 years to 5 years, or 20 years to 10 years, eh, you know, does that really matter? I still think that a lot of the concerns and stuff over SSDs are a little bit blown out of proportion, if not a lot of it blown out of proportion right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. There's a big deal around this when the XM25 was still really kind of let's call it a year ago, 8 months ago, forever ago, as Ryan would say, in terms of covering SSDs.
Right.
And part of the problem is everybody knows, well, I can, you know, the flash memory or some of the flash, you know, everybody understands the idea that flash memory can wear out. Therefore, flash memory is not durable. And the reality is somebody like Intel is dealing with huge manufacturers who want assurances that this stuff is going to last. And OEMs basically wanted, you know, people like Dell and HP and Apple, they wanted to know that an SSD would have a reasonable lifespan. So they came up, it's really funny. Intel decided they wanted to represent SSD lifespan in terms of the amount of gigabytes per day you could write. So they kind of went back and forth, and the OEMs and Intel decided that 20 gigabytes a day was like a typical amount. And you'd be able to write 20 gigabytes a day for 5 years and your drive would last. So Intel basically did the math, and they're claiming you can write 100 gigabytes to one of its SSDs every day for the next 5 years, and your data will remain intact. And that's the problem, right? Is when you're looking at, you know, everybody knows somebody who has had a hard drive die, or at least has heard of somebody.
Right.
But the reality is, statistically, you know, the hard drives last a really long time. The mean time between failure is huge, but it's kind of like airplanes. You know, the mean time between failure as in a plane falling out of the sky and turning into a crater, you know, it's statistically it's much, much safer than a car crash, but people panic a lot more about airplanes falling out of the sky. You know right. what I mean? Like, you know, 42,000 people were killed last year in automobile accidents in the United States alone. But everybody's nervous about flying. So the math from Intel and the other manufacturers basically says, you know, Intel especially, that you should easily get 5 to 25 years out of this. It's silicon. It doesn't really wear out. You know, if you beat it to death with a hammer, if you attach it to like a 5-amp, you know, power supply off of a neon sign and run 10,000 volts through it, if it turns out that Intel did the math wrong and the processor or the silicon inside wears out. But really, right. you know, unless there's been some horribly bad engineering and Intel isn't known for that, you should be totally safe using an SSD. In fact, you should be safer because hard drives have spinning parts. They're mechanical devices. Mechanical yep. devices can fail. Anyhow, sorry. I just get kind of excited about that. So, Pat Factor X, which is definitely not me, tweets, Ryan Shrout, Patrick Norton, should I get an i5 right now or wait for Sandy Bridge? When will we start seeing chips at builder shops?
This is an easy answer. You should wait, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we're literally like 3 weeks away from the release. And with this launch, you will see parts at like Newegg, Fry's, Micro Center, if not day of, if not days before, to be perfectly honest with you, you will see them within the week after their launch. And Intel's already come out and publicly said that they're going to launch Sandy Bridge processors on January 6th, I believe. So that's when you know you're going to see the reviews, if not before. That's when you know you're going to see benchmarks to decide whether or not the performance difference is worth the price difference. And you should actually see parts. Usually they start selling early, like leaked out at some places, but if not, you know, within 7 days of launch. So at this point, It doesn't happen very often where I say you might want to wait, because I'm usually one of those people that says don't bother waiting. There's always something better around the corner anyway, no matter when you decide to build. In this case, it's like, okay, we know there are new graphics cards coming, and we know that there are new processors coming all less than 30 days from now. If you can, I would wait. But if you don't want to, that's your fault. But I think that's a pretty good answer.
If you don't wait and it turns around, your notebook goes on sale for 20% off, or you could have gotten 20% more performance for the same amount of money in 3 weeks, Ryan's going to laugh at you. I will be sympathetic. Yep. On that theme, at Jerome Prolux tweets, at Ryan Shroud, at Patrick Norton, if Apple were to dump NVIDIA for Sandy Bridge graphics, would there be savings in electricity and or performance gains? I would hope there would be performance games over the existing NVIDIA GPUs they're using, but I have not been hands-on yet with Sandy Bridge.
It's not going to be perform. It's a really tough question because
right. It's not that
even
simple.
I don't
that
have a lot of hands-on time with the NVIDIA or with the Sandy Bridge graphics. In general, I will say that the NVIDIA discrete graphic solutions for mobile market will be faster than the Sandy Bridge graphics. Have better drivers, be more compatible with more games than Sandy Bridge. But I don't know. I mean, from all the stuff we've heard, I'm just now getting in hardware. We're not going to be able to talk about performance for a little while, but I do have it in-house. But I haven't spent enough time with it to even know, even if I could say, if it's good enough in terms of graphics performance yet.
I mean, the reality is when you're looking at battery life, the number one the component in your notebook that sucks down the most battery life is still your LCD flat panel. Want a huge gain in battery life? Dim the flat panel down to the point where you can just stand it. And then dim it some more, and that's going to do the most for battery life. The GPU, unless you're talking about gaming GPU versus integrated GPU, the performance gains are huge in terms of like gaming graphics, but the battery life gains are just, I could be wrong. Maybe we'll turn around and see a 15-hour Sandy Bridge notebook from Apple, but I'm not holding my breath.
Yeah, we'll see. Speaking of laptops, we got an email from Hafizan who says, I have trouble choosing about my future laptop that I would probably end up buying next year in the first quarter, he says. I want to use the laptop probably for travel use, like surfing the web and watching HD movies, and probably some on-the-road like gaming. He's an avid AMD lover, but we all know the current AMD laptops run quite hot. I'm hearing a lot of AMD Fusion in the news, and it's going to be launched in the first quarter in a probable AMD Apple Fusion laptop. No point on telling me about the Atom. In my experience, it's like watching paint dry. I like that. I emphasize on battery life, 10 to 12 inch screen, performance, and a good deal. Is it worth the wait for the next gen laptops, Fusion, or stick with the cheaper ones then?
There's a lot of rumors around Apple and the AMD Fusion, but they're an Intel shop. They're not an Intel shop that is so huge like Dell, where they're buying a significant percentage of Intel's output. I mean, they are compared to, say, Bob's PC supply, but the most they might be doing is spreading rumors that they're thinking about AMD processors to get a better price out of Intel. That would be my first reaction to those rumors.
He doesn't say that he definitely wants an Apple machine. I did play with an AMD Fusion Brazos platform laptop, and they are pretty nice. And you are going to talk about 8+ hours of battery life, which is going to be good. Fits his 10 to 12 inch screen type of area. I'm excited about those mobile machines. Sandy Bridge, we talked about it before as well. Those notebooks are going to be ready within Q1 of next year as well. It will be interesting to see how they compare performance and battery life. I mean, that's because my X200 laptop that I've had for almost 3 years now is getting long in the tooth. Parts are falling off because I keep dropping it. My problem. debating upgrading to an X201 from Lenovo, but I know Sandy Bridge versions of that are going to be announced at CES, and they might be available within 3 or 4 months, but they're going to be more expensive. And, I go through the same debate as well. And honestly, I've had, the X201 bookmarked on my browser for a while, but just can't make myself hit that buy button for these exact same reasons.
Well, I mean, it's frustrating, right? I've lived on notebooks. I've had desktops, but I've done most of my computing on notebooks since 1992, and they are without us. I can't think of a single example where they do. They a notebook is a losing proposition. It's like buying a car. You know, you take the notebook. Yeah. You know, you drive the car off the lot. You take the notebook out of the store. You lose 30% of its value right there. Right.
True.
You know, and then they continue to lose value, and you carry them around, and there's stresses on the frame, and you open and close them, and again, there's moving parts that disintegrate over time. Notebooks are essentially doomed by nature. So I would say hold off. You know, find out if Apple, because right now they're sort of a partner, which basically means Apple signed up to get information and maybe work with AMD about talking about the thermal specs or the envelopes for the designs, and can AMD deliver a part for a price that beats out Intel. It'll be fun. And I got to be honest with you, the Core 2 Duo, the 13-inch Core Duo, or excuse me, the 13-inch MacBook Air is a phenomenal notebook. My wife's using one. It's very well built. The performance is fantastic. The battery life is really solid. It'll be interesting to see what else Apple comes out with next year. The iPad 2 is rumored. There's just a whole bunch of stuff in the pipeline coming out from Apple in January and February. Roger, right. Dell Inspiron 9300, which has been really great for several years. That's the best case scenario for a notebook. He says it's slowed down a lot recently. He's downloaded an AVI file that has to be extracted. If I download an AVI file that has to be extracted, it takes forever. If I download it to an external drive and then extract it, it is as quick as ever. Also, about 3 to 4 times a week when I wake up, it has the blue screen saying it is shut down to keep hardware from being damaged. What are your thoughts? Seems like the problem might be with the internal hard drive. I wonder if my first question is how full is that hard drive? Because whenever I hear I download a file and I have to extract it, or it takes me forever to move files around or to copy things to and from my notebook, my first thought is do you have is 20% of your notebook empty? Because as soon as you hit around the 80% point on notebook hard drives, things start to get really crammed in there. And especially with large files, because you extracting files takes a fair amount of sort of scratch space to do. Two, have you defragged the notebook ever? I've had noticeable performance. You're laughing, right? We were just actually talking about this in Texilla this week. We talked about we found a free defrag tool. And I'm going to make you go to texilla.com to find that one because I'm a jerk. But run the defrag tool on your notebook. Because I've had noticeable, people say anything less than 10% defragmenting, there's no point. I've had 5% fragmentation on a drive, defragmented it, which is basically Windows kind of pukes information wherever there's an empty spot on the drive, and a defragger takes that information and puts it all in one spot so that the head can zip around the hard drive and basically pick up all of the data sequentially rather than having to do random seeks. Defragging your hard drive can make phenomenal performance improvements if you've been reading and writing and moving stuff back and forth off that drive for a few years without defragging it. Then third, make sure it's not overheating for another reason. Run a vacuum against the back vents to make sure half the cat hair in the house hasn't been sucked in there over time. Because you'd be shocked. A little bit of heat will start to drive a notebook insane. And also, again, notebooks, they get moved around, they bend, they start to flex. The soldering on the components inside starts to break down. It's tough to keep a notebook alive for a long time.
Agreed.
But yeah. Make sure, make some space in your hard drive if you haven't. Get it down to about 80% capacity, if not lower. Defrag that puppy as quick as you can, and then give it a shot with downloading those files and see if they move a little faster. And if they don't, the nice thing is if you upgrade to a hard drive from a 4 or 5 year old hard drive, you will find phenomenal performance improvements from that drive you had from a few years ago, and probably a lot more space to put more AVIs in.
Nice. We got an email from Jason, who is discussing TVs as monitors again. He says, "Hi, guys. Great show. Just recently added your show to the list of Twitch shows I listen to daily. That's important. Everybody should be doing that. I had a comment from show 97. I run a 32-inch LG 1080p TV for my monitor. It wasn't purchased for that, but that's where it ended up. And I have to say, it's great. People come over and see me playing WoW or even just Quake Live and are very impressed. It does take a little getting used to in browsing the web. It has also gotten rid of my itch to run multiple monitors because I can run at 1080p and have lots of room to have other browser tabs side by side and be able to read them both. So if you have the room, get a big 1080p TV for a monitor. Also works great for streaming Netflix or Hulu."
Yes, it is absolutely great if you're streaming Netflix or Hulu. It is great for video games, especially, you know, if you're like 27, 32 inch, somewhere between 32 inches and 40 inches. And definitely by the time you get to 42 or 46 inch, 1080p is way too low resolution to be using for a monitor of that size. And also, it's just it starts getting to the point where you're reading your way. You know, it kind of looks like you're following a tennis match when you're trying to read data on the screen. Because I've actually been using a 42-inch Sony Bravia 1080p television as a monitor in my testing area for the past couple 3 weeks. And there's moments when I love it. When I have, like, you know, I've got Rain Meter configured and I've got the document I'm working on and the related documents. But to be honest with you, I want like a 4K monitor. I want considerably higher resolution because, you know, 1920 by 1080p, I'm running that on like, you know, 21 inch monitors at home. Now I've got 42 inches of space. So I want to double or triple or quadruple the number of pixels on that screen. So I will literally have this gigantic desktop where I can put all of this information on it. I'm actually 32 inches I'd be down with. Anything bigger than that, I would really, really want a higher resolution. But yeah, if you can find a monitor for cheap, definitely think about it. You know, 42 inches is probably, though, unless you have a really big desk. That's an interesting thought.
Nice. We got another email from we'll go with the pronunciation of Gawain about USB headphones.
That was one of the knights.
Oh, okay. All right. With portable devices and USB headphones, says I have the Astro A30s and I'm thinking of getting something a little more comfortable on the air. It becomes irritating after about an hour, even with the A30s, although the sound is great in the amp rocks. He likes the Logitech G930s, but he's wondering if it's possible to get them to work with a portable device as they are USB based. Is there a way to get them to work with a 3.5 millimeter jack, or is USB the only option? And if not, do they have any comparable suggestions? My main selling points are the sound quality, comfort, wireless is not a must, and durability.
The Logitech G930s are a really interesting choice. I mean, first short answer is no, unless you have a notebook, you know, or some other portable device that runs Windows or OS 10, and I assume Linux, although I haven't played around with USB audio on Linux in a while. I will try to do that before next week. But unless you have a computer with USB ports that supports USB audio, you are not going to – there's no magic box you can plug in between that, you know, mini jack, stereo mini jack, and your – you know, $160 Logitech wireless gaming headsets. And that's the other thing that makes me think, like, this is a sort of a 7.1 emulating headset. It's a wireless 7.1 surround headset, which is a really peculiar choice for portable headphones. You know, what you really need is a set of relatively indestructible headphones or earbuds, and there is a lot of stuff out there. You know, because the other thing is, like, are you actually using a microphone, or are you actually? I'm wondering maybe if you're using. God. Yeah, I mean, if you know, it's with you could kind of. Yeah, I mean, you could kind of turn a surround. That'd be interesting, turning a surround sound headset into like the headset for my speakerphone. there's an experiment there. Creepy. Yeah, it would be a little peculiar. Although I could probably strap this to the top of the headphones and get away with that. But, you know, what you want to do is just get a nice wired headphone, set of headphones. You know, my personal favorite headphones for under $100, Grados SR60s, they sell for about $75. They are a classic, awesome, beautiful sounding set of headphones. They're not great on airplanes because they're open backed. Part of what makes them extremely efficient and they have a very nice low end punch. They don't work so well in planes because you can hear the plane right through the open panels on the headphones.
Now I do want to say the adapter he was talking about looking to go for the USB to the analog. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can do that.
No. Well, no. USB to analog headsets is easy. It's just but to go from like a USB headset to a 3.5 inch phono jack doesn't exist. I've looked.
I mean, because you know, the 3.5 millimeter is just taking an analog electrical signal, right? The USB is taking digital data over that connection, and it's doing processing and that kind of stuff. So no, I don't. I you know did some reading around, and I don't think any of those adapters exist. So you have to find. You're going to have to do what Patrick is suggesting here and get another set of headphones.
Yeah, I'd be curious. I mean, you know, Kost makes great headphones. Sennheiser makes great headphones. Mm-hmm. I've got a pair of Beyerdynamic DT770s I live in. AKG makes great headphones. If you don't want to spend a lot of money, $20, $30, $45 at a set of Kost headphones, you'll get more headphones for your dollars than just about anywhere else. Yeah, that's what I'd say. Like, look at Kost, look at the Sony MDR-V6s, look at the Grado SR-60s, and pretty much anything from Beyerdynamics or Sennheiser. And if I haven't listed your favorite brand of headphones, don't hate me, but there are so many people making headphones these days.
Oh, yeah, so. Tons.
Yep. Yeah. Sorry, dude. I mean, I love the idea of having, you know, not having to have multiple sets of headphones, but once you buy a USB... once you buy a USB headset, you're kind of tied into using that with a computer. And that's just the name of the game on those things.
Agreed.
All right. I think we're going to wrap it up this week. We would like to personally appeal, especially to all our fabulous new viewers who have found us on the iTunes podcast page. I want to thank iTunes for the Best of 2010 Audio Podcast nomination. Thank you guys so much. Do us a favor, email us if you have questions about computer hardware. Twitch at twit.tv is the place to go. You can find more of me if you haven't been completely overwhelmed and disgusted by now at techzilla.com, T-E-K-Z-I-L-L-A. I host a video show with Veronica Belmont and Robert Herron where we get our geek on and all sorts of things, software and hardware. Mr. Shrout, PCPer.com, what's coming up at the awesome hardware website?
So we've got some good notebook reviews coming up soon. I think we're going to look at the Lenovo T410S. We are going to have, like I said, more graphics cards to look at later in the week. Lots of good stuff. New storage reviews coming soon as well, all at PCPer.com. Also, if you want to watch us record this show, instead of only listening to it through the iTunes or Zoom or however you download it, you can come to live.twit.tv Thursdays at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. You can watch us record it before you go download it the next day or two, of course, to listen to it again.
Sweet. So this is episode 99?
Well, this was episode 98.
Did I just say that instead of wrapping the podcast because I'm a moron?
Well,
yes, I'm so excited. 3, 2, ladies and gentlemen, I got to run. Got a hot date with the wife. This is very exciting for us having a toddler. Mr. Shrout, thank you so much. Everybody listening, thank you so much. iTunes, thank you so much. Are you going to be doing some more benchmarking or do you need to go to bed now, Ryan?
No, we're going to be working here a little bit longer before nighttime comes upon us.
Before nighttime comes upon us.
Very ominous.
I think that could be the name of this one. Before nighttime comes upon us. If that became the name, you will know because you downloaded this already. I get a scoop, people. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Trout.
You've been listening to This Week in Computer Hardware. Thanks so much.